part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm not doing part.
Fanboy.com.
Hello.
Hello. Hello. Hello.
Hello, bonjour. Comment ça va?
I have no idea what you just said. I'm a filthy American. Come on now. Or unless you speak Spanish. ¿Hablas español? ¿Cómo está usted?
Gracias.
Gracias. How are
bueno?
You?
Muy bueno.
Close.
Me bueno.
Muy bueno.
Bueno me.
Muy
bueno.
It sounds like you're drifting off into Italian.
Bene, bene.
Bene,
grazie. Buongiorno, principessa.
Oh, God, no. Let's not go there. Although it kind of fits with the theme of what we're going to talk about a little bit, at least the time period.
That's very true. It's a very true.
Well, how are you, Anthony?
I'm a good. Antonio is a good.
Antonio is a good. Very Italian name. Unlike
I think I will do the interview with this sort of accent. Now it sounds French or I don't know what it is.
Yeah, you're slipping. You're slipping. All right. Well, let's begin this wonderful podcast. This is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. My name is the very Aryan Christian Horn, and I am on the phone. On the line, I should not say phone, on the Skype line with the very creative, one of my favorite creators, one of my favorite comic writers out there, Anthony Del Cole, who is the co-creator of Kill Shakespeare and several other comics. You've been working on like Assassin's Creed, a Hardy Boys comic for a while, I believe, which was very good. I read that. It was excellent. And now you have a new book out, which I have read, and I must say it is par excellence. Fantastic. I loved it.
Thank you. I don't know what par excellence means. I stopped taking French classes in grade 9 in North Canada, so I assume it means eh.
No, it does not mean eh. It means, at least my understanding of the phrase, is that it is the very top, the best of the best. I found this to be one of the better, best graphic novel reads I've had in a long time. So I'm very impressed with your work, sir. Good sir.
Wow. Thank you very much. It's very kind of you to say.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's true. And I should say the name of the book. It is called Son of Hitler, and it is from Image Comics. Is there anything that you would like to say about the book now that I have you on the line?
Well, I mean, first of all, you've played it up like nobody else has been able to. So, I mean, that alone, I think we should just stop the podcast here.
No, you've got some great reviews here.
Exactly. Well, no, thank you. I mean, we should just stop it now before it goes downhill. So, no. Greatest, the best book that Christian has read in quite some time.
Yes.
And thank you for tuning in. Next week we'll be back with guest X, Y, and Z. No, thank you. I mean, for those that are listening that are not familiar with what Son of Hitler exactly is, it is a World War II spy thriller tale that explores the legend that when Hitler was stationed in France during the First World War, he fathered a child. This was a rumor that had gone on through World War II. It was never proven. And so our story revolves around the main character, Pierre Moreau, who is this 20-something baker's apprentice in occupied France, 1943, 1944, in the darkest days of the Second World War. And he's approached by a female British spy handler who has found out that Pierre is the son of Adolf Hitler. And she tasks him with a mission, which is to embark on a journey to meet his father, finally, his biological father, Adolf Hitler, and kill him. So I would love to say hilarity ensues, but there is some hilarity. There's a lot of violence. There's spy craft. There's weird medical experimentation. You know, anything that really, you know, if any sort of all the plot elements that make a good World War II story.
Yeah, yeah. And I would agree with that. I mean, I'm a big fan of documentaries and history and World War II, post-war history as well. And I found myself very engaged from the very beginning. I mean, it's obvious. Obviously, I'm sort of like, as I just said, a fan of this sort of thing. So I can sort of, if it's not going in the right direction, I immediately kind of, for me, I immediately would drop out. But you had me engaged from the first couple of pages. And I think the whole thing is just a basic concept. I mean, I don't think I'd ever really heard about this rumor of Hitler fathering a child. I mean, that's a legit thing. That's something that people have talked about or pontificated upon.
It's one of those things that it's not as huge a rumor as other ones. I mean, there's when it comes to Hitler and sexuality, I mean, there is the belief that perhaps he was gay. There's also a rumor that he was impotent. There's a rumor that he only had one testicle. So there's all sorts of things. But mixed up in all that is the question of whether he had fathered a child. And back in the 60s, I believe there was a man who put his hand up and said, "Hey, I am actually the biological father of Adolf Hitler, sorry, the biological son of Adolf Hitler." Uh-huh. But it was never proven through DNA or through any sort of testing. And so, you know, I think he ended up writing a book, but, you know, it never really caught on. But actually, the whole genesis of this book came out of this concept of this guy who had put his hand up, and that there were some rumors during the war. And Jeff Moore, who's our co-creator and co-writer on this, along with Jeff McCombs, the illustrator, and Jeff McClellan, the letterer. Yes, that's three Jeffs in an anthem. But I mean, Jeff Moore was the one that first broached the subject, or, you know, told me about this rumor. And so immediately my eyes just opened wide, and that light bulb sort of went off, and I leaned in. Oh my God, what? Sorry? And I had never heard of it myself. And this was about 7-8 years ago when he first told me about it. And yeah, immediately just the possibilities started to race through my mind. Like, who could this person have been? Did he ever find out that he was Hitler's son? And more importantly, what kind of story could we tell? Like, what happened if they would actually meet? And so we, you know, within the first 30 minutes, we were able to kind of cut through and come up with the main elements of it, that, you know, he is approached by the British Secret Service and asked to find, you know, to meet his father and kill him. You know, that would be the gist of what the story was. But yeah, I mean, it is a rumor. And as you said, I mean, like, you like to watch documentaries or films or television series about it, or read up on this, or even, you know, just go down the deep dives, the rabbit holes online and read stuff. And then there's a lot of people, because World War II is a fascinating time period, and there's so many things that happened. There's courageous things, there's evil things that happened, and there's also weird things that we don't even know. And, you know, I think Son of Hitler is one of those things that kind of fits into that third category.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's sort of the thing, like, the way that you present it, or the way that it's presented in this graphic novel, I mean, it seems quite plausible, because, I mean, obviously everyone knows Hitler for the dictator that he was, but there is this sort of like shroud of mystery about him, particularly like his early years as an artist and like how he rose to power. So being able to sort of like shoehorn in this sort of like missing son, particularly when you're dealing like in an era of like icons sort of not living up to their chaste or pure as the driven snow as they think they are, status, you know, it obviously fits in there really well with what Hitler became and where he came from and what he was. You know what I mean? I mean, it seems just so plausible that when I saw that you were doing this graphic novel, I was like, and then I started reading it, I was like, oh, this kind of makes sense. And it was so well presented that I was like, wait, is this a thing? And I haven't really had time to like track down, obviously, all the research that you tracked down, but you guys did a really good job of like sort of taking this myth and making it sort of very real in a way.
Thank you. I mean, again, the credit goes to the entire team. So Jeff and Jeff, Three Jeffs. Jeff Cubed, I guess. And their last names are all start with an M too. So it's like Jeff M. I know, it's very creepy. And then at Image Comics, we have Jeff Boysen, who is the head of sales, and also Jeff Stang. And so, yeah, there's way too many Jeffs in this, and, you know, and one Anthony.
Jeff McComsey, excuse me, yeah. I'm going to mispronounce it, Jeff McClelland, who is the letterer, and then the cover art is also a Jeff.
Yeah, that's Jeff McComsey did the
cover. Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah. Oops, yeah. Sorry, Jeff. I repeated
okay.
it. Yeah.
Oh, no, that's okay. There's way too many Jeffs, so there's all sorts of repetition.
So anyway, not four, but three.
Yes, exactly. What's really cool about it? I mean, what you're talking about is something that really fascinates me about historical fiction. And I love historical fiction, not only to read it, but also to, not only to create it, but also to read it or view it or experience it, is kind of the great thing about it is that you have the ability. There are certain things that happened in World War II. And unless you want to be a Quentin Tarantino at the end of Inglourious Basterds, spoiler alert, and completely change the war or the ending of it, you kind of have to keep those in place. But to me, the most interesting thing is you have all these pillars, if you will. But what happens in between? And even someone like Adolf Hitler, whose life has been dissected by so many academics and writers and researchers so that we seem to know everything about it, there's still a lot of dark periods or gray periods or aspects of his life that we're not familiar with. You know, as we were talking about earlier, I mean, was he gay? Was he straight? We don't know. Was he bisexual? We don't know. You know, was he impotent or not? I mean, there's all this stuff that just, there's no definitive answer. So I love to play in that sort of gray area, like the, well, what would have happened or what could have happened in that time period? Or in this, you know, like when he was stationed in France in the First World War, could he have, you know, met someone? Could he fall in love with someone? Could he have fathered a child and not even know about it? So, I mean, there are all these little spots that you can kind of pick and choose and, you know, wrap it around in the bow of, you know, actual world events. And to me, that just makes for fascinating storytelling.
Yeah, yeah. And it was Jeff Moore who kind of presented you with the idea?
Yeah, Jeff Moore, fellow Canadian. He's now based in LA working for, I know, it's my, there's four, three Jeffs, one Anthony, two Canadians, two Americans. Nice. So it seems like it's a multilingual, but
international.
It's international. It's an international story of intrigue and spycraft. Jeff Moore was the first one to approach to broach the subject with me. He and I were at the moment, at that time, we were developing a mobile game for Kill Shakespeare, which you mentioned at the beginning of the broadcast here. And so, I mean, we were in development and never came to fruition, but just a really, really smart guy. This is his first comics project, and I'm sure the first of many, because he's one of those guys that just works on another level in terms of just coming up with ideas and just so intelligent and smart. But yeah, he was the one that first broached the subject with me, and he and I went back and forth on what some of the story would be. I then ran with it for a while, and then the inevitable next step is, you know what? I can't draw and Jeff can't draw, so who can? and so along came Jeff McComsey. I think
whose art is gorgeous.
His art is amazing. And the reason that I really wanted him on this project was because of that. I mean, he has this sort of old school type of feel with all of his other projects. He's done the FUBAR series that's been independently published. And, you know, he's done a number of other things. He's out of the three of us, he's the one that's the New York Times bestseller, which I always like to put in every single biography or write up this. Just really talented guy. And so we'd been introduced by a fellow friend who is a reviewer. I think you used to do reviews for Ain't It Cool, correct?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this was another reviewer.
Liz,
so
when, I think.
Liz Lizard Reblin. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So she's the one. Her and I had been in contact, and I asked her if there were any artists that she really liked, and so she named Jeff McComsey. I checked out his art. It was amazing. And so I approached him with Son of Hitler and another project that I've been developing at the time. And I thought Son of Hitler would be right up his alley. And lo and behold, yes, he loved it. I mean, he was busy with some projects for a while. We put together a pitch, sent that out to publishers. Image was always our number one target because since the first days of working on Kill Shakespeare, I always wanted to work with Image. I just put them up on a pedestal, and they do amazing work, and they have an amazing brand. And so I thought this would be the best fit for it. It took a while just because Eric Stevenson and the rest of the team are very busy because they publish all of the top stories and all the top creators today. But eventually he read through it. He really liked it. And he was the one, Eric Stevenson, that is, that suggested that we release it as a graphic novel as opposed to a series of, you know, 6 or 12 issues.
What was the justification behind that? Because, I mean, it is just one novel, but I mean, it's great. But obviously, it probably could have been split up into maybe 4 parts. Was there sort of like a justification for that on his part?
Yeah, I mean, it all boils down to the title. I mean, Son of Hitler is provocative title.
Especially today. Yeah.
I mean, in some respects, all of a sudden you're like, what? You know, it's intriguing where you want to find out more. Like, what is this exactly?
Yeah.
But also anything that involves Hitler today, yesterday, you know, 7 years ago, there's a possibility of red flags. And so one of our concerns from the very get-go was, okay, if we put this out as an individual series, or sorry, like as a series, by the end of the first book, we know, you know, we would have met our main character, our main two characters, both Pierre, the son of Hitler, and then Cora Brown, the spy handler. But we don't know where the story's going. And so with the title of Son of Hitler, we were afraid that readers would start to assume or believe or guess that, are we going to make Hitler a sympathetic character? Are we going to make Nazis sympathetic characters? And so Eric Stevenson was the one that, in one of our meetings at New York Comic Con a couple years ago, he's the one that said, well, why don't you put out as a graphic novel? Because that way, if anyone has any concerns or any questions, you know, just read the story and you will find out that Hitler's not sympathetic. Nazis are not sympathetic. These are the bad guys. They are evil. And so I, you know, again, it's another testament to how smart Eric is. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it was the best step. It was a new process for me. Everything else I had done has always been individual issues. But I really loved it. It's cool to be able to put out something in one fell swoop, get the entire story out there. And Image did a great job in terms of helping us with the design and turning into a really, really nice hardcover book.
Yeah. It's interesting because you mentioned something that I was thinking while I was reading the first part of the book, because obviously this is a very sort of like detailed story. There's ins and outs. I don't want to spoil anything or anything like that. But as far as like dealing with Pierre, who is the progeny of Hitler, you know, I was thinking like, wow, you guys are taking a really big risk because obviously, you know, not to spoil necessarily anything, he's not a Nazi, but you are sort of making the reader almost like want to sympathize with somebody who is the genetic progeny of one of the most horrible human beings that ever lived. You know what I mean? And I was like, was there any concern about that? Because, I mean, obviously you had said, well, let's avoid making Hitler and Nazi sympathetic because obviously we don't want to do that. But then when you get to the point of like, it's such a touchy, sensitive subject that you might not even want to sympathize with anybody who's tangentially or directly related to that character, you know, Hitler. Did you have any thoughts about that? Because while I was reading it, I was like, ooh, I'm starting to feel something for this guy, but I don't know if I should because I don't know where this is going to go. Were any thoughts about that or?
No, actually, obviously we did think about it, but I mean, right from the get go, I mean, Pierre Moreau, you know, the progeny, as you say, he has never met Hitler in his life.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he is not, you know, I mean, when we meet him, he's sort of, he's abstaining from getting involved in the war. He's not involved in the French resistance. He's just living his life as a baker's assistant. So, I mean, I didn't worry too much about it because, you know, I mean, is the fact that Luke Skywalker, the son of Darth Vader, does that turn him into a bad guy? No. I mean, he didn't know that Darth Vader was his father. And the same thing with Pierre. So I didn't really worry about that. Now, what I did worry about, and this is something that, you know, throughout the entire book, I want to make it clear that, you know, I kind of want to make the reader sort of start to worry, like, oh, is Pierre eventually going to go over to the dark side, quote unquote?
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm okay with that because you want to make an intriguing character that possibly could go over to the dark side because otherwise he or she turns really boring. So, I mean, in terms of Pierre, What I really want to do was create someone that was almost, that is sort of like the junior version of Hitler, in terms of, not in terms of like trying to be an evil, but in terms of personality traits. So there's two things that I really honed in on in the writing of it. One is he's got anger management problems or issues, slash he's a loose cannon. So he has a temper. He is the first person to throw a punch. And he just loses his cool quite easily. And that's sort of like Adolf Hitler.
So,
I've been obsessed of late in a lot of the stories that I'm telling in the question of nature versus nurture. I mean, how similar are you to your parents? And how much of it, how do these similarities come from genetics? Do they come from environment, combination thereof? And so we have someone who is the offspring of the most evil man on the face of the planet, but he's never known him, he's never met him, so how similar is he? So like I said, he has anger management issues or temper, but on the flip side, he finds peace through arts and crafts, which is sort of what Adolf Hitler did when he was young as the failed artist. And in this one, Pierre, like I said, is a baker's assistant. So there's an older man who finds a very young Pierre. We have a flashback sequence in really what's the second chapter. And he knows that Pierre is sort of this loose cannon. And so he recognizes some similarities he believes that he can help him out. And so through that, Pierre starts to find some sort of peace. So as long as he's baking, he doesn't have to worry about becoming a loose cannon. Of course, he goes from the ordinary world to the extraordinary world in the story, and there's a lot more to this world than just baking.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So when you're presented with this sort of concept, the idea, how do you approach the research for something like this? Like how deep into sort of the rabbit hole did you go down as far as like the Hitler son sort of, I don't know if we call it a conspiracy theory or legend or whatever, but how much chasing down of the story did you do?
I did some research into that itself, into Hitler and his sexuality, but also at the same time, just assassination plots or assassination attempts against Hitler. All aspects of the story that I knew would come in. So the SOE, the Special Operations Executive, which is basically the spies during World War II for the Brits. The American spies during the war, even Russian spies. All aspects of it. One of the interesting things is that there are so many books, there are so many films and TV series, so many documentaries, just everything, so much media that's been created about World War II. It's almost overwhelming. At a certain point, I just had to stop because it was getting in the way of actually coming up with my story. And one of the things I learned, even on working on Kill Shakespeare, my first comic project, was to do research up to a certain point, and then after that, just sort of free flow, I guess you could say. Because you don't get too bogged down in the history. And so, I think it's okay for an artist, whether it's a writer, an illustrator, a presenter, anyone, documentarian, filmmaker, whatever. I think you're allowed to take some liberties with it. So not everything needs to be exactly as it probably was. But as long as the tone is there, as long as the majority of the information that's presented is accurate and correct, then I think the rest of it's fine. It's one of the fun things about doing historical fiction through Kill Shakespeare to some extent, through Assassin's Creed, now through Son of Hitler, is the ability to sort of do those deep dives into these time periods. And, for the own history geek or info geek that I am, just learn more about about what people did or what life was like in those different eras.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, one of the things that I absolutely love about this book is the look of it, beyond the art. Is the fact that generally the pages tend to be sort of monochromatic as far as like just like one color tone on each page. It starts off with sort of like light blues and hues of blue or that sort of thing, and you develop, I think there's some reds like later in the book, and just it very much reminded me of like an old World War II sort of era movie, or like a 50s movie in that aspect of it. How much of that sort of visual identity did you have, like how much say did you have in that? Was that something that you guys wanted to do directly from the outset, or were you like, let's make it a color book? Like, what was the development on the actual, you know, visual palette of the whole thing? Because, I mean, it is a gorgeous book, just, you know, in its use of color, or lack of use of color, I should say.
Thank you. I mean, one of the great things about working with Jeff McComsey, or just working with a great artist in general, is I like to take a back seat in respect to that. Like, I will work on the story, I'll work on the script, and then when I have complete confidence in someone like I do with Jeff, I kind of let them run with it. But it was early on where we talked about the general look and feel of it, and Jeff was the one that had first proposed, hey, why don't we do something that has that monochromatic feel, so that it sort of almost feels like it's a comic book or a story of that era. So it was a combination of that, and also Jeff and I are huge fans of Darwin Cook's Parker series. And we just really liked what he did with the colors. And so we thought, hey, you know, that was sort of a reference point for us. And so we thought it'd be great to be able to kind of incorporate that kind of feel. So to give the book this sort of the sort of tone, I guess. A lot of it goes, you know, I really have to tip my hat to Jeff on that. And then in terms of the colors itself, yeah, we kind of, it's almost as though the colors themselves are telling a story. So as you say, at the beginning, it comes in very blue, like it's monochromatic and very blue. So, I mean, there are no other colors outside of blue, you know. Then we have flashbacks, which are more sepia tone / black and white. And then as the story goes on, it goes from being blue to slightly a little more gray, slightly a little more gray, slightly a little more gray, until the third act. And the third act is something that came on relatively late in the process. It was only about maybe last summer where I'd come up with this idea of a twist that takes the story in a completely different direction. Because when we first conceived it and came up with the story, we originally thought, okay, this story is going to culminate with a showdown between Pierre and his father, Adolf Hitler.
Yeah.
And we find out exactly what happens to Hitler. Without spoiling anything, don't worry. That is not the ending of the story. You know, there's story beyond that.
Yeah.
And so as soon as it shifts focus into that extra, you know, the final 40 pages or so, or in a traditional three-act structure, the third act, that's where we start to put in into a red color, because it's a different location and almost a different sort of mission, if you will.
So you're telling me that the last, like, say, quarter of the book or third of the book, you're telling me that, how does that work? Because you're saying, like, last summer, did you have like a full script going? And then you were like, wait a minute, I've got an even better idea. And then you go back into your office or wherever, your hidey hole, and start tapping on your keyboard. And then you come up with the, how does that affect like what the artist is doing, what the colorist is doing? Are they like, oh boy, Anthony got this idea, now we've got to scrap like whatever we thought, like, or was it just like you were adding on to something that you had already told? Like, does that make sense what I'm asking?
Absolutely. Yeah. We were sort of adding on to what was already there. I mean, one of the great things about, again, I cannot stress highly enough how great a collaborator Jeff McComsey is. So, I mean, most of the times when I'm a co-writer on a book or a comic series, it'll be just myself and the co-writer. So whether it's Connor with Assassin's Creed, or with Kill Shakespeare, or, you know, anyone else, then it's just the two of us working on the story, writing the script, and then passing over to the artist. But because Jeff has such, you know, Jeff is a cartoonist, so he's both a writer and an illustrator. It was all three of us. We'd have very long Skype sessions throwing ideas around, what if we tried this? How about that? Hey, I was thinking X, I was thinking Y, that sort of thing. So it was about, I think I had already scripted maybe the first 40% of the book, maybe almost the first 50% of the book. And we were just, we had another brainstorming session, just kind of figure out, okay, well, you know, what do we want to do in the second half, blah, blah, blah. And it was halfway through one of these sessions where I said, wait a minute, guys, like, what if this was the case? And there was silence on the other end of Skype. And all of a sudden, like, oh, that would work. And so all of a sudden we were able to kind of riff and just kind of go, oh yeah, then this could happen, or it leads into this or this. And so all three of us got really excited about the concept. So no, it wasn't the sort of thing where we had written the entire thing and then I woke up one morning, oh, I know how this is supposed to end. no, that wasn't it. It was a very fluid process. We were already, like I said, I think I'd only scripted about 40% of it at that point. And you know, we were kind of just talking about what exactly happens in the second act. Like, how do we get from that 40% point to the end? And then I said, well, I think we need to go from that 40% to the end and then some. And so, yeah, we did have to tack on more pages. We had to cut out a couple things just to make sure it all would fit into the ideal page length, which is too bad because there were some really interesting subplots that I would love to explore in a future version. You know, whether we do this for film or TV, I think we can add that in. But it was all in service of this ending, which, you know, I mean, I'll let the readers be the judge of it, but I think it might be the best ending I've ever come up with for any of my stories.
Oh, I think it's fantastic. I mean, I think the ending is fantastic. So when you guys sort of decided to change the course of the ship, was there any art in production as far as like towards the beginning of the book, or were you just still in the writing process?
At that point, I believe Jeff had, Jeff last year was quite busy with another project that he was finishing. So he would sort of dabble. He would do a couple pages here and there. So I think at that time we definitely had the first chapter. So the first 26 pages or so. Yeah. And then I think he was maybe starting the work on maybe chapter number two, or he was about to. So we didn't have to go back and change any of the artwork or anything like that. We had to go back and change some of the lettering. And for me, I'm the sort of writer in comics and graphic novels where I will continue to change the dialogue up until the very moment that they pull the keyboard away from me. You know, like, Anthony, we have to send it to the printer right now or else it will not be printed. Get your hands off the keyboard.
That's great.
So, yeah, so that first scene, which you talked about, just really getting excited about or allowing you to really dive into the story, that even that scene, I changed it up until the last possible moment to sort of tinker with, especially the Cora character, because for those that are listening, it really seems like this is Pierre's story, but in fact, it's a two-hander. So Pierre is the titular character. He is the son of Hitler, but Cora Brown, his spy handler, it's just as much her story as Pierre's. And so, you know, I really wanted to kind of make her as strong as possible or make her just as interesting as possible. So when we first started, we really did focus on Pierre. Like, this was, okay, what is Pierre's arc going to be? What's the beginning of a story? What's the end of a story? And then as we continue on and then, you know, along the entire process up to and including this big twist, Cora became more important, more and more central and more important, more and more important in this tale. So really, I do like to think of this as a two-hander, and I really wish there was a way we could have put her on the cover to really highlight the fact that she's such a fascinating character. In fact, you know, I talked about the ending or like this third act being the favorite third act of anything I've written. I think that Cora might be the most intriguing character I've created. With the help of Jeff. But yeah, I mean, I think she's really fascinating because much like Pierre, who's sort of, he's a loose cannon one moment and a zenful baker the other moment, Cora is so obsessed. She's so driven. She will do whatever it takes to get, she's obsessed with finding Hitler and killing him and ending the war. But she also has her soft spots. She has her weaknesses along the way. And so, yeah, I mean, for me, she's a very complete and complex character.
Yeah. I mean, I do want to talk about Cora, but I'm still really fascinated sort of with the change that you saying that you sort of made the change, not at the last minute, but sort of like as you were sort of getting ready to develop once the art was starting to go into production. I mean, just a year ago, that just fascinates me because what happens towards the end definitely informs many of the interrogation scenes in the beginning, again, without spoiling anything. And did any of the art have to be changed in the beginning, or did any of the beginning of the story or the I guess part of my question too is like when you're writing, are you doing sort of like not Marvel method, but sort of like, this is panel one. You know, in this panel, the Germans are being interrogated and this person walks into the light. And like, are you doing like detailed panel descriptions? And how would that change have affected what you were doing in the beginning, or did it at all, I guess?
It seems though there's two questions there. The first question is, how detailed am I in terms of scripts? I like to think I skew a little towards the detailed side.
Sure.
To it. Like, I will break down, okay, page one has five panels. This is happening in panel one. This is panel two. I will often try to throw visual references. So here's a hyperlink to this sort of room, this sort of character, this sort of pose, that sort of thing. So, I mean, I will often do that. However, again, when I'm working with someone like Jeff McCumsey, I use that as a beginning or a starting point, and then I let him go to town. So there's a lot, majority of the pages, he would make changes to.
Sure.
I mean, he would cut down the number of panels. He'd add to them. He'd change a little thing. Oh, I think it's better to capture this emotion. It was a really, really great team in that respect.
Yeah.
And then the second question is regarding changing. Not really. No. I mean, because when I came up and when we started to brainstorm this ending, I realized we have a lot of the elements already in place. Like, there are characters that are introduced in this first chapter. There are scenarios that are introduced, information that's introduced that will make it go, that's already there. It's already there, and all we have to do is just slightly change some of the motives or slightly change some of the dialogue, and it will allow us to still, to not have to change in the artwork, but still hit those major points in the final act of the story.
Sure, sure, sure. And then as far as Cora is concerned, has there been any thought, because I mean, to me, she came across very as, and this is sort of maybe a sillier character comparison, but very like Agent Carter, sort of like in like the Marvel, whatever, cinematic or, TV universe, that sort of character, but much more serious and driven and realistic than Agent Carter is. In my mind, I'm sort of picturing, like, have you given any thought to maybe developing that character more and, going into like what her World War II, other missions might have been? Because there are time gaps in between, like things that happen. So, I mean, I just liked the character so much, and I thought she was a very great sort of female protagonist. Has there been any thought to that? Because you've said like you do like the character, but is there any idea of like doing like sort of like the Cora Brown Chronicles or that sort of thing?
I've done a lot of press in the last 2 weeks for Son of Hitler and for the release. And you're the first person in the media to ask that question. There are a couple other people in the film and TV industry that have asked that question.
Oh, really?
Said, hey, like, is there a sequel here? Because I can really feel like there's a sequel or prequel involved for the Cora character.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm glad you kind of noticed that. Yes, Agent Carter was one of the reference points that we had, in terms of look, but also in terms of some aspects to her. But it was funny because as we were working on it, at a certain point, I kind of took a step back. I was like, you know what? This is almost like the origin story of the Judi Dench M character from Bond.
Oh, cool.
And I realized, oh my God, like that's kind of cool. Like, oh, this is how M might have started. And so, yeah, she's a really fascinating character. So, yeah, I haven't, up until a week and a half ago, I hadn't even thought about doing a prequel or sequel or anything involving that character. But based on some questions and even this conversation, it is something. It depends on how successful Son of Hitler is. I mean, if it becomes a huge success, then hell yeah, I'll do it. And I'm sure people will want to read it. But as I said earlier, there were some aspects that needed to be cut from the story, and there were some scenes or some moments with Cora in between some of the actions that's taken place, like not in the end, but more in the middle part that we had to cut or that we weren't able to really do just because of time constraints. And, we wanted to hit a certain page level. Otherwise, in terms of cost and in terms of getting it done on time and on budget and that sort of thing. So, I mean, I would love to tell more of the Cora Brown story.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see why it couldn't be sort of like a Queen and Country sort of thing with Cora Brown, but in World War II or even communist era,
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it's funny that you mentioned Queen and Country, because one of the pull or one of the blurbs that we have at the very beginning is from Greg Rucka.
Yeah.
And when Jeff McComsey and I sat down and sort of asked ourselves, well, who would we love to be able to read this and write something for us, Greg Rucka was right at the top of the list. So I was extremely honored that he not only read the book, but he really liked it. And he was he put together a hell of a quote for us.
Yeah, yeah. So let me ask you about the thing that you first sort of came to my attention for, which was Kill Shakespeare. I mean, I noticed that you were involved in the with the writing of the last chapter. Are you sort of done with Kill Shakespeare? Or are you going back to it? What's happening there with you? Because, I mean, that is a book that I've really loved. And as you know, I've been very effusive about it over the years whenever I've had you on the podcast, which I think our last chat was like years and years and years ago. But I'm still a very big fan of that. And you've been working on other projects. What's going on with you and Kill Shakespeare?
Do not worry. I'm not. I'm still trying to kill Shakespeare. The guy just won't die. He just will not die.
Good for all of us.
All of us. Exactly. Yeah. No, I mean, I'm still involved in Kill Shakespeare. I mean, Connor McCreary, my Kill Shakespeare co-creator, he was the one that put together volume number 5. And I had to step aside from that mainly because I was too busy with other projects. So obviously with Son of Hitler took up a lot of my time last year. Assassin's Creed Origins, I have a series from Marvel that'll be coming out later this year.
What?
Oh,
can
yeah,
you talk
yeah.
about that?
Unfortunately, I cannot. I'm actually sitting down with my editors tomorrow, so hopefully they'll be able to tell me when exactly they'll make the announcement. You know, hopefully, I'm sure it'll be in the next couple of weeks, because I think they're looking to release it in September, October.
Like the big time now. You're in the big time.
I like to think so, but every time I think I'm in the big time, there's always something there keeping me humble.
No way. I could say I knew you when.
Yeah, exactly. No, so I mean that, and then also I've taken I'm now getting into writing for audio dramas.
I saw that.
Yeah, so last year I had a audio thriller, a found footage thriller with Audible that was released that hit number one, called Unheard, The Story of Anna Winslow. Like I said, a found footage thriller about a woman who... an American student, grad student who's over in the UK, and as part of a research project, she puts together a podcast to investigate the disappearance of a fellow classmate. And then as she does the investigation, she finds out all the weird stuff that was happening revolving around this missing girl. So it was the fact that it hit number one and had I don't even know what the download figures are, but they were quite high, and Audible loved it so much that now they've greenlit my next two series.
Wow.
So I'm going to start to work on that in a couple weeks. But yeah, so I was quite busy last year, so unable to really put any time into the Kill Shakespeare comic version. However, Connor and I are still working on Kill Shakespeare. We still have a TV development deal with Universal Cable Productions. And we're in the midst of, I actually just got off the phone with the studio about an hour ago. So we're close to circling in on a showrunner to work on it with us.
Oh, wow.
You have not heard the last of me in the Kill Shakespeare world.
That's great. How did you get into audio dramas, though? Like, how different is that from creating comics or whatever else it is that you're working on? I mean, I mean, the only audio drama I think I've ever really listened to was a podcast called We're Alive, and it was like a zombie thing, and it was very well produced, but it seems like a lot of work, like especially if you want to make it sound as good as it can, like sort of like an old time radio show. How did you like fall into that?
All roads lead through Kill Shakespeare. So in this case, I was at the MCM London Comic Con, I don't know, like 5 years ago maybe, and then one of the development execs from Audible came by. She was really intrigued by Kill Shakespeare and was wondering if we'd be interested in doing an audio version of it. Which ended up coming to light come to fruition. We did produce something with Audible Germany. So if you are German or understand German, you can listen to a kick-ass audio version of Kill Shakespeare through Audible Germany. It's amazing. Like I have no idea what they're saying, even though I scripted the lines, but it sounds incredible. Like the special effects, the music, the acting, everything great.
Wow.
And so from there, I just kept in contact with Audible in the UK. And then I ended up having brunch with Rebecca Fenton, commissioning editor there here in New York a couple years ago. And I pitched her this concept of a found footage thriller, and she loved it. And I put together the pitch, and then eventually they said, yes, that's great, let's greenlight it. So I wrote that. Actually, I ended up writing that, I think, in 2016 and then some of 2017. And it wasn't released until late in 2017. I kind of found that way now based on that, or on the success of that. Like I said, I have two new projects coming, and I've got a couple other pitches I'm developing, because audio dramas / fictional podcast, whatever terminology people want to use, because there's no one set term or vernacular used for it. I think it's going to be the next big medium for storytelling. You have to just look at how huge podcasts have become, especially after the huge success of Serial and S-Town, and look at American Life and Reply All, and all, Gimlet Media has some amazing stuff. So just look at all that success in the in the nonfiction sort of realm. And I really think that fictional storytelling in audio is going to be the next big thing. So I hope that, I'm glad that I'm part of this renaissance, if you will. And it's a really fascinating format, because there are constraints, there are a lot of constraints by it. When you create something that can be consumed through listening through someone's earbuds, it's a very intimate way of telling a story, because you're right there, you're in their ear, and you can scare them, you can make them laugh, you can make them cry, as long as you know how to do it.
Yeah. Were you surprised when you were approached with that? Were you like, this is still a thing? People are still doing audio dramas? Because I remember when I discovered that other podcast that I mentioned, I was like, oh, wow, what a genius, because obviously podcasts had been out, but I'm like, wow, what a genius idea. People are starting to make dramas and use their podcast for that sort of thing. Were you aware of that sort of thing, or did it surprise you that somebody approached you with that? Or
they didn't really surprise. It wasn't a huge surprise. When they approached me, the only time they ever approached me was just at the very beginning. When they said, oh, have you thought of doing Kill Shakespeare? Because they were just there scouting and looking for something. And I said, oh, yeah, I definitely think this could be cool. I didn't think anything would come of it. But then, as I always do, I like to follow up with people and say, hey, it was great to meet you. And then we had a conversation. We had the discussion over email for over the span of 6 months after, it took them a while to read it. And then they're like, oh, this is really interesting, and that sort of thing. So, and then from there, I just became really entranced by the medium. And so that's why I approach Audible with this pitch for Unheard. From there, now I'm talking to a lot of the major players. I'm fortunate because I live in New York, my wife and I, and so I have the ability, a lot of the main podcasting companies or audio companies are based here, whether it's Gimlet, Panoply, Midroll / Stitcher. Stitcher and Midroll just put out Wolverine and the Long Night, which is, it's the first time that we've had a branded superhero story as a fictional podcast.
I'm gonna have to check that out.
You should check it out. It's really well done. Midroll is one of the top companies. They really know how to tell good stories. They got Benjamin Percy to write it, and for the life of me, I can't remember the name of the actor that they got to play Logan. But it's a real, and they got some great cast, not name cast where I know that person, but if you were to look at the picture of the performers, I'd be like,
I know that guy.
It's really talented. They got some of New York's top Broadway and television talent on it. From there, I know Marvel is interested in doing more in the audio drama realm, and Midroll would love to do more. I think a lot of licensed brands are now looking at it as possibilities. So you're going to have stuff in the superhero genre, in the licensed genre, and then as new original IP. And really what it's going to take something like Serial, or S-Town, or something like that, Serial was just a huge phenomenon. And so I think you need that one central story that's going to make people kind of take notice of audio dramas. Because right now, when you look at television, say, television or film, the majority of stories that are told are fictional. you know, I mean, maybe 10, 15% of stories that are out there are documentaries or nonfiction programming. Yeah. And when it comes to podcasts, it's the exact opposite, where 85, 90, 95% of the stories that are told are interviews or nonfiction documentaries or that sort of thing. And you have your homecomings, your life afters, you know, the bright, you have your bright sessions, like those sorts of stories, but those are still in the huge minority. But I think over the next 12, 24, 36 months, they're really going to rise. And once you have that one huge mainstream hit, then that's going to open people's eyes and really get them excited and check out some of the really good stuff that's out there. And there'll be even more in the pipeline.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah, I mean, I can only say, like, as far as podcasting goes, I mean, I would think that a lot of it would be interviews and stuff like that, because they tend to be sort of like easy to put together, like produce. Like, I can only speak for myself, but like my own podcast, this thing, Part-Time Fanboy, you know, it's very easy for me to put together as long as I have people willing to participate and join in, you know. So I can see why that type of podcast would explode. But when you're talking about audio dramas, it seems like there's a lot of production work that, you know, sound effects, all that stuff that goes into it, that would make it sort of a little more difficult for somebody on a like lower budget or a tighter family schedule, you know, to sort of engage in. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. No, it is something that, and that's one of the obstacles that storytellers need to overcome in terms of the audio dramas creation of. Because, yeah, I mean, it's people have short attention spans. They can be easily distracted. So you kind of have to keep that in mind. And so when you're putting together your story, make sure that it's, you know, when you start a new episode, you have to do the previously on or some sort of way to kind of get them back into it.
Oh,
otherwise,
yeah,
you completely lost them. And it's, yes, not as simple as, oh, previously on Unheard. But, you know, like, what is the, you know, I mean, in Unheard, the technique that I had was every episode would start with her sort of narrating her podcast, like, hey, this is the latest that's happening, and this is who I researched, and blah, blah, blah. But this is, you know, I need to figure this out. And so that you almost knew that that would be the subject of that episode. In other versions, you're not as, you know, it's not as easy. So you have to come up with interesting ways of including some sort of narration. No narration. I mean, is it first person, second person, third person? Like, there's all sorts of different ways of exploring it.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, you know, congratulations on everything, Anthony. I've been a fan since the beginning, and I love all your stuff. I love Son of Hitler. I mean, I don't love Hitler, but I love Son of Hitler. And I just think that, you know, all the stuff that you've done, I've really enjoyed. And I'm sorry to have been out of touch for so many years, but...
So many years, Christian.
It's been years. I know you've missed me.
I was dead or something I did. I just
bothering you. No, honestly, like, you guys have always been super nice to me and super generous with your time. And is there any place that you're going? Are there any conventions that you're going to be making appearances at soon so people can check you out or pick up Son of Hitler or Kill Shakespeare, any of that stuff?
I mean, conventions, there aren't any in the next couple months. I mean, I will be attending New York Comic Con in October. Nice. If any listeners are in the New York area, I have signings coming up in the month of July. On July 10th, I'm signing at Word Bookstores in Jersey City. On July 11th at Forbidden Planet, one of the top comic shops in the country. So that's on July 11th. And then on July 25th, I'm doing a talk at the New York Public Library Grand Central Station. So those are the New York appearances. And if you follow me on Twitter, at Anthony_Delcol, or on Facebook, then you will find out about any other future appearances. I probably will be heading out to L.A., at some point in the next month or two for some meetings. And at that time, I'll probably set up a signing, and then also going back to my home and native land, Toronto, in August. And I'll probably set up a signing or two up there as well.
Nice, nice. You're not coming back, are you, when you go up there? You're going to stay, right, the way things are going down here?
I've had so many people ask me to buy my passport.
Yeah. You might get another one here. Well, thank you for your time, Anthony. I really do appreciate it. The book is called Son of Hitler. Is it out this week?
It's out at bookstores across the country and across, I think, the world this week in the English language. Absolutely, yeah. So if you – I don't have a specific website. Yeah, if you just Google Son of Hitler, you can get it at Barnes & Noble and on Amazon, any comic book shop or any bookstore that carries graphic novels.
Son of Hitler, Image Comics, the creator is Anthony Del – do I keep pronouncing your mispronouncing your last name, Del Cole?
It's close enough. It's Del Call. So Del like the computer Del and call like telephone call. So
it's close enough. All these years.
That's why I didn't return your calls.
Yeah. Oh, it's terrible.
So it's myself, Jeff McComsey, Jeff Moore, and wait for it, Jeff McClellan. So the four of us, three Jeffs and an Anthony, have created Son of Hitler with Image Comics.
Yes, and I love it. I think it's one of the best graphic novels out there right now. You should track it down. It's fantastic. It's a great read. It would make a great movie. I love it. My name is Christian Horn. This has been the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast, and you can check us out on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all that great stuff. And our email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. Thank you for listening, and we will be back soon with another episode. Bye.
Part-time fanboy.